azt is lehet, hogy ilyen félkű benne lesz.
A lélekesen. Yes. Can you say one word?
One word.
Oh, okay. That's it?
That's it. Okay. Left, right.
You can't read it, the screen?
It's not very readable because of the sound.
Yeah, but it's necessary because there is one verse that I would like to show you, but it's only the third question.
Okay.
First of all, I thought that for the introductory class it would be interesting for the students to tell how the volumes after Srila Prabhupada's disappearance were made. So I don't know whether you could tell me how you cooperated, the team, and who did what, and how it was all done.
Yes. Well, the history is, originally Prabhupada appointed Pradyumna Prabhu to translate the rest of the Bhagavatam. But Pradyumna was, he didn't organize himself, so he got very little done. In 2.5 years, he translated 5 or 6 verses. Ridyananda Maharaj had the desire to take over that service, and so, you know, he asked the GBC to assign it to him. I guess he invited me at that time. This was must have been 1979 or 80, maybe the end of 1979. So the team was initially just him and I, and my role was to translate the commentaries, the verses and the commentaries, give a something of a translation, turn it over to him. He would revise it and make, compile a purport based on the draft translation of the commentaries. Then after about a year and a half, Dravida Prabhu joined us.
Dravida,
yes. When I relocated to Florida from California after spending a year in India. So that was in the beginning of 1982 that Dravida became part of the team. And he was a very integral part. He actually did a very good editing. And he would do the editing before we gave it to Ridyananda Maharaj. So Ridyananda Maharaj was already receiving an edited copy. And then we would revise again after Ridyananda Maharaj worked on it. So it went around like in a cycle. Mm-hmm. It was a team effort. Mm-hmm. Everything was based very closely on the three major commentaries of Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, and Vishwanath Chakravarti. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't any much need to create a commentary. It was just, all we had to do was use the material already presented in the commentaries.
And when you, for example, cite Madhvacharya, he's cited by these three commentators? No.
Madhvacharya's commentary was included by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati in the Gaudiya Math edition. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we cited things that he said.
Mm-hmm. Which edition did you use for the, for example, the 11th canto?
We were using different editions of each commentary. I had editions of the Sridhar Swami's commentary and the Krama Sandarbha of Jiva Goswami. I was using primarily the Puridas editions. And for Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary, we were using using the Gaudiya Math edition. Primarily. Later on, we had access to the Ahmedabad edition with all these commentaries in it, and we would refer to that too, but still it was primarily, that was the arrangement, the Puridas edition for the two commentaries and the Gaudiya Math for the other.
And you use, or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, who is also quite...
Which one?
Bhakti Siddhanta,
especially in the 11th canto, especially because he gave elaborate Bengali comments in the 11th canto, but not so much in the other cantos. We also always referred to his Bengali translation of the verses, as Prabhupada himself did. Prabhupada relied very much on Bhaktisiddhanta's Bengali translation for putting his English translation together. Yeah. I don't know what else you want to know about that.
Nothing specific comes to my mind.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, what, just one thing. That when I read the 11th canto, it was very obvious that at the beginning I thought that I would never finish it because there was any studying it, because up till the 4th or 5th chapter there is huge commentaries, purports to the verses.
Yes.
But after that the purports grew quite small. Or
yes. And in the 11th canto.
In the 11th canto. So up to a certain point it was very kind of very elaborate and very a lot of purport. Maybe it was because of the nature of the verses. I was thinking about
yes.
it only afterwards, but
I really can't explain that without looking again at the original material and looking at what we did with it. It was so long ago. I mean, this is about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I can't remember why that would have been, why the commentaries got short all of a sudden in the 11th canto.
Could it be just because it would be so voluminous if you had carried on with these very
yes.
long purports that just couldn't fit into two volumes or one?
I don't think that was the conscious thought. Maybe it's just there was an initial enthusiasm in Vidyananda Raj, you know, and he wrote very deep, elaborate comments in the beginning and then sort of slowed down after that.
In the structure of the 11th canto, nothing just...
I can't remember. I just can't remember whether that's there in the original Sanskrit commentaries, that shift... To more brevity, I don't remember at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That can be looked at, but I haven't looked at that in a long time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It seemed to me that the 11th canto is a kind of summary, or sums up the whole. It's very like the Bhagavad Gita itself, because it's very not much. The story is the frame, like the beginning and the end.
The bulk of the middle part of the 11th canto, the Uddhava Gita, is philosophical.
Yeah.
It's not a historical narration at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extended philosophical discussion, in the style of the Bhagavad Gita, but longer.
Yes, and...
And most of the Bhagavatam, the philosophy is scattered. You know, there's the philosophical points raised in prayers and various conversations, but not systematically. So it's not the style of the Bhagavatam. The system of the Bhagavatam is historical narration, and the philosophy is just here and there, unsystematically. So that part of the 11th canto is a different format. Just like the Bhagavad Gita, is a break in the narration of the Mahabharata.
So can it be said that the 11th canto is something like the Bhagavad Gita? The 11th canto to the Bhagavad Gita is something like the Bhagavad Gita to
the Mahabharata? Well, in particular, the Uddhava Gita, part of the 11th canto, yes. 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 And it takes, similarly, a penultimate position near the end. It's not near the end, but at least it's at the beginning, just before the battle. You know, it's near the culmination, say. And so the 11th canto appears after the 10th canto, which is the culmination of the Bhagavatam. And the Kriyagita appears just before the battle, which is the culmination of the Mahabharata. Yeah.
And so, can the main topic be identified in the 11th canto, or it's just all topics, or is there a...
You can make a theme, but the Bhagavatam doesn't stick to one topic. Mm-hmm. No canto is all about one topic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, renunciation is a major theme in the 11th canto. But it's not that you won't find renunciation discussed elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But it's a primary focus, a primary focus in the 11th canto. Mm-hmm.
And devotional service being the highest is also.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Concerning the 11th canto, I have only one more question.
Yeah.
And I have just a few others. It's a specific verse. That was the only verse that disturbed me a little bit, because it struck me as, when I first read it, it struck me as a little bit Christian. And I know that it's not, but just my perception of the verse was like, so I would like you to explain to me philosophically this verse, because it's about the creation, how God, the creation of species, and introduces verses which treat the human form of life as the best for God realization. So it's an introductory verse to that. It's,
yes.
And yeah, it's in the 9th chapter.
Okay. Yes. Yes, I know the verse. There, somewhere else, I think in the 3rd canto, where the demigods congratulate Brahma for creating the human species. And there the clue is given. The reason why is that human beings are the ones who maintain the demigods by performing sacrifice. So in that sense, they're the most valuable. The demigods are superior to them. Materially and sometimes spiritually, to the human beings. Still, the human beings are crucial or essential. They're in the middle position, but that in that middle position, they're doing a lot of work to maintain the whole creation. They're maintaining the maintainers by their performance of sacrifice. So that's why human form of life is the best for self-realization. If you become better than a human being, then you become distracted by your power for control and enjoyment. Whereas human beings aren't, then you have to live an extremely long time. So you cannot complete your life, perfect your life in a short time, but you can in the human species. Therefore, the human species is the best. So I don't think that's not Christian. No. That's consistent with our theology.
It's not the part that I thought was Christian, but this wording that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, expanding His own potency, Mahesh, created innumerable species of life to house the conditioned souls. Yet by creating the forms of trees, reptiles, animals, birds, snakes, and so on, the Lord was not satisfied within His heart. Then He created human life, which offers the conditioned soul sufficient intelligence to perceive the absolute truth, and became pleased.
So this, yes.
Because, so this, the Supreme... Somehow, this because the Supreme Personality of Godhead doesn't. The material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. So this, in a sense.
I don't know what the problem is.
That yeah. Immediately when I read this verse, this biblical notion came to my mind. God created light, and then I don't know animals, and then created man, and became satisfied, or something like I don't know the creation.
Okay.
The Bible, so that, and he became satisfied. So it's so, because.
Well, it's not that God is. I don't think we. Apart from whether it's what kind of historical fact the Bible is narrating, I don't think we disagree that much with the concept of it, that God did create either Himself or through His agents. We're not saying that the Supreme Personality of Godhead did all the work Himself. We know that Brahma was a delegated creator. That's our history. And but still, God is satisfied. It's not that He's not satisfied before He did it. God is always satisfied, but he's especially satisfied that the human form of life is created. It's the best facility for reviving your Krishna consciousness. So that's the reason for Krishna to be satisfied with creating the human species.
But isn't that the human species is eternally existent as a, it's just a, I don't know, it seemed to me as...
It's not that that material, anything in the material creation had any value in itself. Better that there was no material creation at all. But if conditioned souls, if souls are going to fall down from their spiritual position, then they require a facility for coming back. So it's assuming that there are conditioned souls, therefore God's satisfied that there's some human form of life for them to enter into so that they can recover their transcendental nature easily. That's all. I mean, it's not that God is happy that the living entities are in Maya.
Yeah.
He hasn't put them in Maya. This the Christians can't answer. The Christians, the Jews, the Muslims cannot answer why God allows us to suffer. We can explain it. Mm-hmm. And the blame is not on God, it's on us. But that concept of karma, based on the misuse of volition by the living by the finite living entity, is the reason why we're in material life. God didn't put us here, you know, in the sense of just making us be fallen. But you know, every other religion has got an idea that God put us into the Garden of Eden or some other place in the material world. You know, and told us don't eat that apple, and we ate it anyway. And you know, but that's not our version. God didn't create us as material. He did. I mean, the jiva is an expansion of God, and the human form is created periodically. It's created by the agent of God, by Brahma, the creator of the universe. He creates the bodies of all the species. And that's what's really being discussed in that verse. It's really Brahma who's the doer here, not Vishnu. Well, I'm hearing this out of context. I don't remember what the context is. Mm-hmm. What the Supreme Personality of Godhead is doing here, creating different species of life, when it's actually Brahma's business, I don't know, because I'm reading it out of context. Mm-hmm. But we know that it's actually Brahma who does that, who creates the bodies. Mm-hmm. Supreme Personality of God is behind the scenes, and he can be feeling satisfied, but he's got he's got Brahma and others doing the actual work. Provides. Well, he provides the original intelligence behind all of it. Yeah, it's all according to his desire and his plan. Yes.
And so, the expression "the human life"
that means the human that's the human material body. It's a material form. Yeah.
Like
it's a vehicle for. Well, it's a vehicle for sense gratification also, but it's a good vehicle. It's a mediocre vehicle for sense gratification, mm-hmm. and an excellent vehicle for spiritual advancement.
So it can be referred to here as a vehicle, in the sense of being a vehicle.
It's an instrument, yes.
An instrument.
Everything material is for exploitation. Matter has no intrinsic value of its own. It's just with living entities exploit it for their purposes, then it has some value. Gold is valuable because you can do things with it. Otherwise, it's just a rock. Yeah. Because it conducts electricity, because it can be used in jewelry and whatever. Therefore, gold is valuable. Otherwise, why is it any more valuable than just quartz or something? So, the human form of life or any material form is valuable only because of what it can be used for. I don't know if that answered it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. And the rest is a little bit a mixture of my recent experiences in France and a little bit of my plans.
Yes.
To write thesis.
Yeah.
Just a few things that throughout my studies and my attendance of courses and everything, I somehow I directly experienced or saw that this whole ontological field is just, I mean, it's, we say that it's speculation, but it can be verified that it's really just speculation, because in Indology they have very few tangible things, and even if they have tangible things, the interpretation is always subjective. Even if they have archaeological artifacts, it's always subjective. But even Indologists sometimes say that for example, Basham, he said that the Indologist's job is to apply his imagination, but in a controlled way, because there is so few proofs or so few tangible facts to base.
There isn't much actual control. It's a new field. It's only a few hundred years old. It's a small field. There's only a few hundred Indologists around. And they're imitating the hard sciences.
Yeah.
You know, the humanities in general are imitating real science. And it's not very scientific. This kind of, you know, it's really shoddy research. They wouldn't get away with it in other fields, in more established fields. They wouldn't get away with such, unfounded speculations.
Yeah.
And because there's so few other people in the field, some of the other people can actually check what they're doing, they get away with it.
Yeah.
Maybe 150 years later, someone will point out that, the theory that everyone's been going by for 150 years is ridiculous. But, that kind of correction is rare and very slow to come in the field of Indology. There are other fields where there's, many more people working on it, and they've developed their techniques, much more thoroughly. But this is a really backward field amongst scholarly departments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's also like a religious sect, Indology, in one sense, that they believe in some, or it's a very destructive thing, because they want to destroy everything which is noble and Vedic and whatever, with their ideas.
They have to, in order for them to survive, to have an excuse for existing, they have to destroy all faith in Scripture.
All faith in Scripture and prove that everything comes from tribal things, and it's just like they just adopt the evolutionary theory in whole and apply it to Indology. From simple things, simple practices.
And even people who have an attraction and some appreciation, they still have to serve the devil. Just like this Hardy who wrote this book on Virya Bhakti.
Question.
It started off nice, the whole culmination of his presentation is to destroy all faith in the Bhagavatam.
It was actually written by Tamil people in Sanskrit, and so he was examining the similarities. So he was proving,
Didn't prove anything. He borrowed some theories from others on that, and really didn't present any evidence at all about it.
But my teacher is so, she doesn't say that it's true, but I tell you what she said last time, before I left, because the Bhagavatam was somehow the topic, she was treating regionality and pan-Indianism and everything, and she was so fiercely preaching for this theory of the Bhagavatam that she said that only Hardy says that it was originally written by people whose mother tongue was Tamil, but it's a well-established fact, theory, whatever, thesis, that the Bhagavatam was written in the 10th century by Alvar, in an Alvar environment, among whom there was not one Brahmana, and the reason for them to write about North India was that North Indians suppressed them so much that they were forced to write about some other part of India instead of themselves, or
strange. Strange.
So she was presenting this.
Okay, it's an idea. You can have it as an idea, but it's not established. It's not established beyond a doubt. The one thing they say that we do have to deal with is that the Bhagavatam is not mentioned much in earlier literature up to the 10th century. Mm-hmm. That there's not much mention, or maybe hardly any mention in any kavya. Kalidas doesn't refer apparently directly from the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. Although Shakuntala story is actually based on the Bhagavatam. But you could argue that he got it from somewhere else. So somehow the Bhagavatam was forgotten. You know, it seems like they do have a point there, that in the medieval period there was not any much awareness of the Bhagavatam at all. Mm-hmm. The Bhagavatam seems to have been forgotten for most of the historical period. Mm-hmm. To go back to what, you know, traceable literature, you know, that can be dated 1st century AD, 1st century BC, up to about 1000 AD, nobody says hardly anything about anything that can be identified as coming from the Bhagavatam. So it seems that during that whole period, there was hardly anybody was aware of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam had become forgotten. And we should we probably have to accept that as a historical fact and be able to explain it. Bhagavatam's eternal, but there's a hiatus there when the Bhagavatam was forgotten, and it takes up most of what's known period of history from, you know, from.
But then, according to our notions, how did it become manifested again?
Especially by the revival of Vaishnavism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there was still very few people who kept this tradition or memorized it
We don't have any evidence that in the period between 0 AD and 1000 AD that hardly anybody was doing anything with it. Although we could. I mean, we've got authors like Jayadev and others. I wonder whether you can say that Jayadev doesn't refer to the Bhagavatam. They teach, I think Hardy does. Is that, you know, he claims that the Gita Govinda doesn't take anything from the Bhagavatam. And I don't know. I don't know if we tried to do counter research, what we'd come up with.
It's for my personal.
Okay, but this is something that devotees want to get involved, you know, in dealing with the critique of the Bhagavatam. This is where research does have to be done, mm-hmm. to show how the poets of the Middle Ages somehow some of them did, were aware of the Bhagavatam and were using it. I would look at Jayadev's Gita Govinda especially, and see if any of it can be traced back to the Bhagavatam. Because the Gita Govinda is seminal, you know, all later poetry, you know, is based on it. All later devotional poetry.
But then, because I didn't know that the Bhagavatam was kind of extinct
he makes that point, you know, and I couldn't, looking at Kalidas. I just did some quick looking, you know, I didn't do any thorough research, but I looked at Kailas, and I really couldn't see anything that could be proven to come from the Bhagavatam, that couldn't be derived from the Hari Vamsha or some other, or Vishnu Purana instead, or some other source.
But how then the text survive?
How did
the entire text survive for that long period? It was so much longer.
Well, that's not impossible. There can always be, you know, a small underground movement that keeps it alive, or somehow just the text is there. I don't know. I mean, Sridhar Swami comes in the later period. Sridhar Swami is, you know, we don't claim him to be older than the 13th century, and we don't have commentaries going back to even before the 13th, 14th century.
And usually, how long does it take for a text to be commented upon? So, does it happen immediately if it's,
Before printing, it would probably take a generation before a text could circulate all around. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 to 100 years. Depending upon how popular, how quickly it became popular, mm-hmm. for a text to be known after it's written. Maybe with some exceptions, some things might circulate really quickly just because they were hot topics. But something really new would probably take about a generation to become established and known. I don't know maybe that's going off on a side topic, you know. But if we have any real interface with the field of Indology, that's where we have to mm-hmm. push forward our ideas mm-hmm. in showing that the Bhagavatam, you know, if we can counter it that and show that there were poets who were aware of the Bhagavatam in the Middle Ages, you know,
yeah.
before 1000 AD.
You
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, please, please. Yeah.
So concerning the Bhagavad Gita, it's there are also similar theories about the Bhagavad Gita that contradict totally our Siddhanta and everything. And our,
yes.
And but they are so. They are so unfounded, or that I thought that it would be a really nice thing to do the introductory part in a way that I would present the theories that are considered to be established, and I would like to trace back where they come from, because usually they just come from speculation and they just get widespread somewhere.
Right. Very often they're based on very shoddy scholarship. And because nobody else has done any other work in the same field,
yeah,
it's accepted as absolute truth,
yeah,
for generations. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's. I thought that I would do it for dating, because they dated. They say that it was written between the 2nd century BC until the 2nd century AD,
yes,
usually, but sometimes the period is a little longer. Some say that until the 5th century, it doesn't,
yes,
really matter. And it has at least 2 authors, but maybe more.
Yes.
And
have you read all the secondary literature on the Gita?
No, not yet. But no, I haven't read all the secondary literature, because actually there is not much secondary literature and those who on the Gita.
Yeah.
Those who write about the Gita or the monographies that appear around the bicentennial of the first English translation. They,
yeah,
complain about the lack of studies about dating of the Gita, and some authors,
really,
say that, but
yeah,
there hasn't been done any substantial research on these historical.
Well, that theory makes it easy for you then.
Yeah, it makes it easier for me. But still, it doesn't change the fact that Indologists consider it. I mean, they just present it as a well established thing that it was written in that period, and it has.
Then you have. It would be good to show that it's not so well established.
Yeah, that it's not so well established.
What actually is your topic?
My topic is it's actually my topic is on the verge of Indology and translation theories, because I was initially involved. I mean, I wanted to do something about the English translations of the Bhagavad Gita, how they are different and why they are different,
yeah,
how the personality of the translator, the education of the translator and his beliefs and everything is reflected in the translation he does, that there is no such thing. Because when one devotee was defending his thesis, someone told him that why he used Prabhupada's translation, why he didn't use a more objective translation, and it struck me as very strange,
yeah,
because in translation theories the theories are more advanced and they don't claim that translation can be objective. It's just a far out thing. So I just wanted to show.
Well, there are different theories. I've read a little bit of translation theory, and some may try to claim that there can be some sort of objectivity sometimes in translation.
Yeah, maybe, but I don't know whether it's applicable.
You can talk. I mean, you can have a continuum. You can talk about being more objective. I can see that. You know, you can talk about being more accurate and more transparent, even though it's an impossible ideal. You can still tend more toward it. You can certainly be off the wall and just taking off and, you know, not sticking to the original at all.
Mm-hmm.
And some translators do that.
Yeah. Well, it's. It's such a, in the Bhagavad Gita itself is such a poorly researched topic in France that,
yes,
anything could be interesting for them. So simply the fact that if I choose a few translations and show them key verses, so they are different in the different translations,
yes,
and why, I thought that would be interesting. And just I haven't.
Are you sticking to modern 20th century translations? Are you going back further? And you. And are you looking at various languages, or just English, or what?
I just wanted to do it with English, because English was the most productive language in,
okay,
Bhagavad Gita, and,
yeah,
I don't know French Indology that much, and it would be another thesis, so it's just,
yeah,
too much. And first, for the preparation of the thesis, I looked at the whole period, and I just chose 5 or 6 translations from all over
okay.
the period. But
yes.
it's not very effective, because the language also changes. So it,
yeah.
I thought it would be better to pick one period.
Yeah.
Period which includes Srila Prabhupada as well. And so I thought the 60s, 70s or something like
that. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And just a
yeah.
few translations, just for the sake of illustration.
Yes.
In a French thesis, they expect you to present the secondary literature very thoroughly and the theories and everything, and then do something original. But this whole background is meant to be very voluminous or.
Yeah. Yes.
So.
You read the book about Trikala Gita.
Trikala Gita, no, I
haven't. No, I don't remember. I don't remember whose book it is. There's 3 different levels of the Gita. The Gita was composed at 3 different times.
Mm-hmm.
It was a popular theory, and then around 1930, it was dismissed. But I guess, I don't know, for about 30 years it was a predominant theory.
Mm-hmm.
And it was proven to be real shoddy, it had no foundation.
Yeah, but somehow it still worked its way into the heads of Indologists,
yeah.
because they still quote things, without quoting the author, but theories just
yeah.
remained.
Yes.
Somehow, so.
But I would advise looking at it, because that's one theory that had a lot of influence and was proven to be really unfounded.
Mm-hmm. I would be curious who proved it to be unfounded. But
I read something, but I don't remember it. Yeah, I don't remember.
But it's a good point. And also there is that. Some Sinha, some Hugendra Sinha, I think.
Hmm?
I think Hugendra Sinha, he wrote a book in the 80s about the original Gita, the Gita as it was. Shivaram Maharaj quotes it in his Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada Sutta. So he reduces the original Gita to 80 verses. And Basham also says in.
Sure, that's not. Maybe that's the same person.
This is later. This is much earlier because he wrote in the 80s.
1880?
1980s.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So it's a later one, maybe just an echo of this one, and an uninformed theory because
yeah.
he didn't. But Basham also says that it's very unlikely that the Gita could last 18 chapters because it needs 2 hours to be recited, and the battle was about to start, so the most probable thing was that the original Gita lasted only until the basically the end of the second chapter, until Krishna answered, Krishna convinced Arjuna to take on the battle, and all the rest was added later. But it's stupid because I thought.
Yeah, I mean, the philosophy of the Gita is much more systematic than that.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been put together so haphazardly.
And everyone says, not everyone, so, but the most well-established theory is that it's just a compilation of an unsystematic compilation of different philosophical schools.
Yeah.
So it's just a juxtaposition of different philosophical thoughts, and it's without any system, and so it's just kind of a very whimsical thing. But there are others who say, like, I don't know, but a few Indologists.
Yeah.
For example, one with a Christian background says that he sees the system in the Gita, and he's convinced that it's a unified work. And
yes. Is he the only one?
No, I know there is a French Indologist also, but the French Indologist who says that it's unified, she says it's Madeleine Biard, she's kind of more known in the Anglo-Saxon world also.
Yeah. I mean, it would be best if the Indologists themselves are proving for us that the Gita is unified. If the onus is on us to come up with the proof, then they're not going to be so easily convinced.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because we'll show our system and they'll say, well, that's just your system. You know, yeah. Your acharyas made up this system. But if those who were faithless recognize for themselves that there's some system there, that would help a lot.
So there are some people who say that it's unified, but all of
it's
them
sort of important to show that the Gita, you know, is one piece. You got to show that it has a unity.
The only problem with them is that they all claim that it was conceived as a response to the spreading of Buddhism.
Buddhism, yeah. Well, tough. It's tough. I mean, you could argue, give arguments why it just doesn't make sense to be a response to Buddhism, because it doesn't suit the purpose, and it does a lot of other things that has nothing to do with Buddhism. And
why
I don't know. I mean, I'm saying this would be the counter argument to show how it's neither, you know. It doesn't stick to the purpose. It, you know, serves many other purposes beside defeating Buddhism, and it doesn't really serve the purpose of defeating Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
I just say the Gita. You know, that's not what the Gita is about. You know, but I'm just saying, you know, if you can prove that, I don't have the proof for it, but you're ready hand. Yeah.
Nothing can be proved, because it's my speculation is just as good as theirs in their sense, but still. Maybe to circulate some ideas at school.
Yeah, but if you can show what's being discussed in the Gita, you may have, you know, there may be so many ground, there's maybe some opportunity for different interpretations, but some things are obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, that you can identify the topics that are being discussed with pretty much certainty. And if the topics are irrelevant to the questions of Buddhism, mm-hmm. irrelevant to defeating Buddhism, then you show that it has nothing to do with Buddhism. How is it supposed to be an answer to Buddhism?
For example, ahimsa was not very. It was not a very popular. I mean, it was not a very common thing before the Bhagavad Gita, and Bhagavad Gita kind of, because their theory is that Hinduism is a very inclusive thing. It doesn't oppose anything. It includes anything within itself, and that absorbs, and that's how it's
co-opts.
And, yeah.
So it co-opted ahimsa?
Ahimsa, yeah.
How is ahimsa the theme of the Gita? The theme of the Gita is stand up and fight.
Yeah, but there are the ahimsa. So it's both together.
But Krishna's not preaching ahimsa. Where's the ahimsa in the Gita?
Like the offering of a fruit and leaf and whatever. He's easily satisfied with that too.
Okay, the idea of vegetarianism. Boy, but that's not the essence of the Gita. It's just, it's, you know, if you took that statement out, it wouldn't change the Gita.
And also that this whole, because they say that this whole thing, the whole Vedic Hinduism was for householders and karmakanda and everything, and that the Gita is preaching renunciation, and that's a Buddhist thing.
Oh, but so are the Upanishads.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, then the, you know, why don't you say the same thing about the Upanishads? That they're also even though the Upanishads are known to go back, you know, at least to 500 BC, at least 1000 BC, older. What do they generally think is the date of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad? It must be 800 BC at least. No more recent than that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also a response to Buddhism?
And it also
it's renunciation is being pushed in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad just as much as it's being pushed in the Gita.
Yeah.
And, I mean, how far is your Buddhism supposed to go? I think, you know, that Buddhism is about a little bit later than 800 BC.
Yeah, what is it, 6th century BC?
Yeah, 6th century, 6th or 7th century, yeah. BC, so you can show, if, you know, renunciation doesn't prove, you know, that it's a reaction to Buddhism, because we got renunciation being preached even stronger in the early Upanishads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because problem with these Indologists is that Indology is such a vast thing that they just can't read all everything. Nobody has read the Puranas except for Ludo Raja. Even him. So nobody has read anything original. They just pick up everyone else's ideas and they concentrate on their own. But they pretend to be experts in Indology in general. Yes. But they don't verify anything. I read such stupid things about Gaudiya Vaishnavism, and I can only verify it because I know Gaudiya Vaishnavism better than anything else. And it was a book published in 2003 or something, or 2004. It was published by Blackwell, and it's called Hinduism, it's a collective work.
Yes.
And there was an article about Vaishnavism in it, written by accidentally a French Indologist in English. And in the whole section of Vaishnavism, he treated the Vaikanasas for some reason.
Yes.
Almost. And at the end, he gave just a very, very drafty survey of the rest of Vaishnavism.
Yes.
And he mentioned modern movements and he made factual mistakes, like the Gaudiya Math was. The Prabhupada was appointed by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur to be the next. To be his successor in the Gaudiya Math, which is a factual mistake. And it also stated that ISKCON was funded by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. But I mean, but
really?
With this, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness was funded by Bhaktivinoda Thakur. I mean, such. Yeah, the idea came from him, but it's just a mistake. And if someone doesn't know Gaudiya Vaishnavism, they just. About this multiple authorship, I thought that. Was it such a common practice to, in those days, to take a text and then add parts to it, other parts to it, and claim that it's the same thing? Because, for example, in the case when the Bhagavad Gita was translated into, I forgot what the Gyaneshwari, it's in Marathi, I think.
Yes.
It's a different text, so. The author doesn't claim that this is Bhagavad Gita, and
Ganeshwari is basically a commentary.
Yeah, it's a commentary, but I mean, I don't see why. If someone wants to prove something, why should he use small text and then add his part and claim that this is same? I just don't see why they love so much this idea of unknown. I mean, anonymous authors who just
because. There is a tendency. I don't know how far back it goes, but it certainly shows up more and more as Kali Yuga progresses. The tendency to cheat. 12th canto warns us: Vedad Pashanda Dushita. What happens in Kali Yuga is that the atheists come and pollute the Vedas. They do it by writing spurious texts or adding parts to texts, and we can trace in the Puranas, especially trace evidence that this is happening. I picked up the Saura Upapurana, which we have a copy of. And I just opened it up at random. And it was a chapter about the demon Madhu taking birth on the earth in the form of Madhvacharya and teaching diabolical dualism.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously, to us it must be obvious that some Mayavadi wrote that chapter and stuck it in this very little known Upapurana.
Mm-hmm.
In order to push his own agenda,
mm-hmm.
he instead of writing a whole new Purana, he just inserted a chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do that, the unbound manuscript, you can just slip in some similar looking pages and.
Mm-hmm.
Or make a copy and just insert some chapters as you're copying it.
But can you do it? Because
and then whole books are written, somebody writes a book in order to establish what he wants to teach, and then claims that it was written by some ancient rishi, or that it's eternal scripture. that's a common thing, unfortunately. Because in India, new works are not as respected as something that was written, spoken by Lord Shiva to his wife or written by some ancient Rishi. So, therefore, false claims are made that books are ancient when they're not. And sometimes chapters are deleted or inserted or changed in existing scriptures. We see that. It happened a lot in the Puranas. The Bhavesha Purana is full of spurious chapters. Because it's supposed to be a chapter about the future, so that's the place to put it. To put in something that supposedly is being described before the fact, when actually it's after the fact. So it does happen. We have lots of evidence of it in the Puranas, of texts being amended and perverted. And also other examples of whole new texts being written.
But the Gita text is practically unaltered.
I think the alternate readings from that period on are minor. And I don't know, the Hanuman Bhasha might be even older than Shankara. I think so.
And who's the author?
We don't know who it is. I mean, some claim that it was Hanuman himself, yeah. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's not older than Shankara. I don't know if we can really date it with certainty. Yeah, but at least back to the time of Shankara, the text of the Gita is fairly well fixed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he also quotes previous commentators whose commentary doesn't exist anymore, but still.
Yes.
So
yes. But that doesn't cover the 4,000 years and more before Shankara.
Yeah.
Someone could argue that Shankara just arbitrarily decided to fix something as the text, and everybody else respected his opinion after that. Mm-hmm. He's so influential that just because he does something doesn't mean that it was like that before, that it was the state before he came. He could have changed it himself, and everyone else followed him.
Why wouldn't he write more Mayavadi Bhagavad Gita? Why such a Bhagavad Gita is so many devotion in bhakti as a highest amount?
Well, I don't think the argument is that he made, completely rewrote the Gita, but he could have made some revisions. He could have gotten away with making some changes. Maybe he did, they could argue. Maybe he did. Well, I'm just speculating right here. Someone would then say that even in his time the Gita was so well known that he couldn't get away with changing the Gita because everybody knew it. Mm-hmm. So many people knew the Gita. Going back even to Shankaracharya before, that it's not a kind of text you can easily get away with changing, because it's familiar.
But only to few people. I mean, to few Brahmanas.
The Gita?
Yeah.
At what period?
Shankara's period.
We don't know. Nowadays, it's certainly not just a few Brahmins who know the Gita.
Nowadays, no, but popularity of the Gita today and at those times.
Well, I don't know what you can say about the popularity of the Gita in the 6th century, whether it was more, less or more popular then, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whether people were more familiar with it in the 6th century than they are now. Mm-hmm. People used to become real pundits back then, better pundits than they are now. And to memorize the Gita is nothing. It's like, swallowing a peanut. Yeah. They were memorizing huge chunks of things back in the 6th century. So they may have been more familiar. I don't know what the evidence is about it, but basically all we know about the 6th century is the books that still are present, that's all. Mm-hmm. We don't know much what was actually going on back then. Mm-hmm. We just have books. We don't have much concrete evidence about life in the 6th century in India. Mm-hmm. Especially intellectual life at that time, we don't. We just know from what was written, preserved in books we have.
So I wouldn't just let someone tell me and accept it as fact that the Gita was less well known in Shankara's time than it is now.
Mm-hmm. But it's quite certain that the Gita is much more known now than before the first English translations, Hindu Renaissance,
much more well known. You mean worldwide, or
in India? Yes.
Well. That's the recent history.
Yes.
If you went back to the 16th century, I think you'd see a different situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay. I mean, the later Mughals and the other Europeans and the British did such a job on India. Yes. That they the British especially discredited traditional education so well that
mm-hmm.
people started forgetting even the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
So nowadays, a lot of people don't know the Gita at all. But I think if we go further back before the European influence became strong in India, I think the Gita was pretty well known back then.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can find historical evidence of that. That there was strong Brahminical education. I don't mean education of Brahmins, but education with Brahmins as the teachers
mm-hmm.
in the villages and all around India
mm-hmm.
up until beginning of the 18th century, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after that, that's modern history, mostly intentional policy of the British government, yeah,
mm-hmm.
to undermine that education. So just because the Gita wasn't known before the translations, but if you go back enough before it, it was known.
Mm-hmm. Can the Chaitanya Charitamrita be cited as some kind of evidence of that Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami cites Gita and Chaitanya Charitamrita, which was meant for a broad audience?
Well, he also cites the Bhagavatam more than he cites the Gita.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah. And the Sanskrit commentaries on the Bhagavatam and other topics of interest to Vaishnavas often quote the Gita, assuming familiarity, just quoting it as if you're supposed to know what it is. So at least people who know how to read Sanskrit were expected to be familiar with the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
As far back as you can find commentaries about anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At least, Vaishnav literature, works by Vaishnava Acharyas, they're always referring to the Gita and referring it to it with the assumption that the reader is familiar with what they're citing. You'll find in Shankaracharya's own Vedanta commentary, other Vaishnav Vedanta works, there's frequent reference to the Gita.
Mm-hmm. Who's the first commentator who's considered to be Vaishnava commentator and field commentators, who's known?
Well, historically, the big one is Ramanuja.
Mm-hmm.
He would be the oldest major Vaishnava systematic philosophical writer.
Mm-hmm.
That's not counting the Alwars and Yamunacharya, the others in the earlier Sri Sampradaya.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't so much, up to Yamunacharya, they weren't so much systematic philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
You had others like Yadava Prakash, Bhaskara, who were Vaishnavas of a sort, but they were sort of mixed, half impersonalist, half Vaishnavas.
Mm-hmm.
You have some others who were not easily identifiable who they were, Bhagavan Upavarsha, but he was a commentator on the
On the Shabarabhasha, on the Mimamsa, so what, you know, whether he was a Vaishnava or not is uncertain. There are, Ramanuja refers to several previous Vaishnava commentators on the Vedanta, but they're only known from a few, from the few citations that Ramanuja himself gives. So they are supposedly Vaishnava acharyas on the ancient Vaishnava acharyas on the Vedanta, but we don't know them. We don't know anything about them. Yes, we have the names and a few snippets of things they said. It's apparent that Shankaracharya's own Vedanta commentary was so influential that it eclipsed most of the previous commentators. Mm-hmm. And therefore their works are lost. Mm-hmm. Probably because of the how prominent Shankaracharya's commentary became. Mm-hmm. And it was only at least 400 years after Shankaracharya that Ramanuja wrote his commentary. So in that period, Vaishnav literature and Vedanta was pretty much forgotten, mm-hmm. lost. Anyway, that's... Maybe we're getting way off the topics of what you wanted to ask about.
No, it's in my topic. It was kind of...
Okay.
It's okay. I think I have no more questions.
No?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's just one thing that to indulge is I think you cannot preach to indulge, not preaching, but you cannot present your views as absolute truth. You can't prove anything to indulge in general. It's just kind of useless. You just can't present it as a theory. And
yeah. Maybe. And
if it's well researched, then.
But yeah, then. Yeah, but what's accomplished ultimately?
some other goals.
I mean, we should make certain points, mm-hmm. to them. You know, I think we have to defend the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is our whole faith is based on the Bhagavatam. If these people can convince our devotees that the Bhagavatam is not authentic, then that's a serious blow, mm-hmm. to the Krishna consciousness movement. So I think we have to at least prove that it's not necessarily so.
Yeah.
You know, that their theories are not solidly founded, and our devotees shouldn't lose faith on the basis of them.
I meant that personally, for example, to my teachers, used to preach the idea or something.
To convince them of something?
Yeah, Not like in the broad.
Yeah, okay.
Scholars, but like person to person. It's not because they.
I don't know them, so I don't know what you can do with them. Yeah.
And in India, they can be made more favorable towards ISKCON or consider it more authentic and bona fide and everything. But,
yes.
But it won't alter their atheistic beliefs.
Yeah. Anyway, they should be impressed that they can't just take cheap pot shots at us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. They should respect us. They may not be convinced to think like us, but at least they should respect our, that we have. You know, mm-hmm. That, yeah, we're not completely unfounded. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's okay. If you have anything else, while you're still in India or afterwards, you can write to me.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Or maybe next year, because my thesis is going to be written, finished in 2007, so maybe next year also I have some questions.
Okay.
And I'll write you in the meantime if there's something.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Yeah, if you have anything specific that involves secondary, you know, something somebody says in some secondary literature, I don't have access to it here. Mm-hmm. I don't have access to a library, so you may have to Xerox the relevant parts. If it involves something that somebody says, you'll have to present it to me so I can see it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Well. All right. I got to go home now for lunch. Yeah, take that home off and then. I don't know. It's probably only picked up my voice and not both voices. I'm going to have to put that through the chair again. Let's give it to Jimmy.
Thank you. Recording.